From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. On this show, we dip into the Writer's Talk archive for a discussion we had with Joe Crookston about songwriting and researching songs. Joe will be playing in town this weekend with the Six String Concert Series. More information is available at www.sixstring.org. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Joe Crookston.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Tell me, when you're going to write a song, what do you look for in a situation when you want to write a song about it? What tips you off that this is something you should be writing about?
Oh, that's a good question. I think for me, writing is a lot about the human relations and the human interactions in songs. More and more, I'm finding. I actually just finished this project where I travel around the Finger Lakes region of New York. And I have this kind of joke where I've always had this aversion to relationship songs, the kind where, like, the guy breaks up with his girlfriend, and then he sings these really depressing songs about how he's all miserable, you know. And right. I never quite, that wasn't something that I was ever that interested in. I was always in search of stories about people's lives or my own life, but that had a much more universal kind of appeal. So for me, when I'm looking for stories, when I think about what's in this to in terms of creating a song, for me it's about having characters and people where there's a story and it has a very universal theme to it. So that's something that I'm very passionate about, and I tend to gravitate towards the real people. There's people in my songs. And their lives unfold in the song. So, yeah.
Tell me about your travels through New York and the type of people you met there. How were you able to relate to their stories? What stood out for you? Maybe you can connect a couple of songs.
Yeah, my newest CD has a number of these songs from this project. And, I mean, it ranged anywhere from this song about during Prohibition in 1928. This guy I met, Walt Losey, had some neighbors who had a farm. And they had a whiskey still on the farm, which is, you know, basically was really common during Prohibition in New York. Everybody was getting drunk making whiskey. And so he told me this great story about how these roosters would go out and get completely drunk eating the fermented mash that was discarded from the whiskey still. And just having this, like, 83-year-old guy tell me this story about how these roosters were staggering around town, to me that was just this great little gem of an image. And I ran with it, and I just created this kind of swingy 1928 swing kind of a song that's called Red Rooster in the Mash Pile. And it's funny, upbeat, kind of a danceable kind of thing, and people love it, and I love playing it. So to me, the songs, they range from something as, you know, funny and upbeat as that to I spent, you know, a number of days and got to know a woman who lived in Auschwitz for 3 years. And I ended up writing a song about her experience, and so it ranged, you know, anywhere from these drunken roosters to, you know, the Holocaust and this woman who basically her and her 9-month-old daughter traveled to America on the boat, and, you know, and basically I with her, you know, I crafted the song, and it took me a long time to get it to where it wasn't just me telling some story that wasn't connected to me. I felt like I had to really get inside of her and her story and do it in an authentic way. So I met all kinds of freaks and wonderful people. I really was, you know, farmers, jugglers. I basically, what I would do is I would take out little ads in the, like, small local newspapers and say, you know, Joe Crookston is traveling around, you know, doing what Woody Guthrie did in 1941. He's collecting stories and, he's writing songs. If you have any stories or, you know, an anecdote that you want to share or, you know, something like that, please get in touch with him at blah, 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 blah. And so I would get a lot of emails and phone calls and letters from people who say, oh, you know, my uncle helped, you know, the Wright brothers, you know, develop the engine for the, you know, that kind of thing. And so I really met a lot of wonderful people that way.
What kind of questions do you ask somebody when you're trying to write a song about him or her? How do you, you know, figure out whether the Wright brothers, say, connection is something that you want to base a song on? How long does it take to figure that out?
The first question you asked there was, like, how do I begin talking to people about it? And I kind of stumbled on this because the idea of interviewing someone about their life can be kind of tricky. I think I have a pretty good personality for it in terms of I'm pretty easygoing and, hey, you know, I'm not very uptight when I'm with people. So I think that helps. But aside from sticking a microphone in their face and saying, tell me something profound from your life, you know, which most people would get freaked out by and go, whoa, you know, who is this guy? I basically came across this or came up with this idea of asking people, can you think of a one-liner or an expression or a phrase or a saying or something like that that someone in your family used to use all the time, like an uncle, grandmother, mother, father, whoever. Like my dad, you know, he used to always say, you got to hit it to get it. That was like, you know, his thing that he'd throw out there all the time. You got to hit it to get it. Like, if you're going to do a job, do it right. You know what I mean? And so I would ask people that. I'd say, can you remember a one-liner? And they'd go, oh, yeah. You know, everybody has one. Everybody has them. I've never met anyone who, like, just absolutely has no clue what I'm talking about. And oftentimes that would turn into, oh, yeah, my grandfather had an expression that was, you know, he'd say, don't hang your straight door on someone else's crooked wooden frame, you know. I'm like, that's a brilliant line. Don't hang your straight door on someone else's crooked wooden frame. But it was too long, so he would say to the kids, don't hang your straight door. But they knew what it meant. It meant basically like staying true to who you were, that kind of thing. So it unfolds where this guy was a woodworker and a cabinet maker. Do you see what I mean? It was just by asking that line and him remembering that opened up this whole window into his grandfather being a woodworker and a cabinet maker and all the, you know, the tools and the chisels. And so instead of just saying, tell me something profound, it was really a way to pry open a window and kind of get in. And I found that worked a lot, actually. And I still use it. People come up to me after concerts and they'll say, oh, I have an expression, you know, or something like that. And so some of them are hilarious and some are, you know, cliches that we've all heard. But many of them I'm getting, I have a whole book of them that I've collected. And some of them are like, you know, get good before you get fancy and stuff like that, you know, good ones.
Yeah, I was just wondering how many were unprintable.
Yeah, one guy said, well, every time I left the house, my dad would say, right home when you get VD, which is, I'm like, that's twisted. Like that. Not like if, but when, you know.
Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah.
But people have expectations that aren't always met. Speaking of stories, artists feel, or they say they feel responsible for the stories that wouldn't otherwise be told or documented. I take it you feel this way a lot when you're writing about people and their songs, and that was the impetus behind the whole journey to New York?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think I value stories a lot, and I value the power of someone telling any, you know, something from their life and have it be heard and listened to and celebrated. I think that's a very powerful thing. I think in our culture, you know, it's nothing new that we have big media, Fox News, and, you know, then they basically pump out the story of the day, and all these other people under the radar, you know, their story is going unheard, untold. So I just think I do. I really believe in the idea that people love it when they can tell their story and have it heard and celebrated. Like the idea of Walt Losey, the guy with the red rooster in the mash pile. I'll do these concerts now, and he'll come with, like, you know, six of his family members, you know, and he's, I guess he's 84 years old now. And he'll show up and sit in the front row, and, man, he's just, like, I'm playing Red Rooster in the mash pile, say, ah, you know, and all the crowd singing along or whatever. And Walt Losey's sitting there just beaming, you know, and he's like, This is from my life. This, you know, I inspired this art, you know, so I think it gives him a real sense of pride and kind of he's amused by how something as little and meaningless as that has become this wonderful celebratory thing in a concert, you know.
You say you're a social anthropologist.
Yeah, or like a social archaeologist, you know. It's like that idea of, you know, digging for fossils, you know, and like feel like I'm kind of unearthing some of these stories. And yeah, that's maybe a good way to think about it, social archaeologist or something.
What is there about music, you think, that makes it a particularly viable medium for documenting history? You know, usually we've got words, printed words generally, and pictures, things like that. But we often don't think of music, I think, in the way that your intent is using it here.
One thing that struck me was during the inauguration here of Barack Obama and watching Pete Seeger up on stage with Bruce Springsteen singing, "This land is your land," you know, and it's kind of like, well, most people think, oh, cute folk song, I've heard it, Woody Guthrie song, you know, but whatever. But there was this moment for me where I was watching that, you know, and it was like, it mattered. The words mattered. People were really singing it like they meant it, you know. And then to watch, like, Aretha Franklin up there singing, you know, America the Beautiful, and having Yo-Yo Ma, like, I guess I was really struck by how much of a prominent role music took in this profound moment in American history of the, you know, of this inauguration. And I was really proud of that. And I think that it's because music transcends these heady, cerebral borders or whatever they are. I think it just really transcends that to a place that connects people. And I just really think that, like a song, I have this song called Abel Baker, Charlie and Dog. And it's about my grandfather who helped build the runways that the Enola Gay took off from on Tinian Island. Mm-hmm. And there's people who never even knew what the Enola Gay was, or they didn't know what Tinian Island or where it was. Like, there was this, and I think because it's in a song that's 4.5 minutes long and the details are very vivid, that moment has come to life for them, and they've told me this, like, I never even knew that happened. I never, you know, everybody knows the bombing of Hiroshima or something, but that's the end of it. So for them, the song allowed them to, in an easy way, enter into this whole historical moment and be moved by it emotionally so that they cared about it on a deeper level than they had in the past. I think that's what music can do. It takes 4 minutes, you know, just wham, you know, and to feel something and care about something that you haven't really thought about or cared about before. And that is a beautiful thing.
It seems to me, and I'm a fan of folk music, so this is probably self-fulfilling, but it seems to me that folk music is one of the genres that cares about that. Pop music generally, you know, doesn't seem to care about making that kind of emotional connection, or at least my reading of Britney Spears suggests this.
I hear it.
You know, tell me, how do you describe your music to people who aren't familiar with folk, and how do you try to get across to them the different things that folk is doing?
It's an interesting question. I don't find myself explaining myself that often, really. What I do hear a lot is people will happen to come to a show, or I might be opening up for someone much bigger than me, and or something like that, and or some teenager or whatever, someone will come up to me and say, "Wow, I don't even like folk music. Like, I've never been interested, but what you do totally knocks me out." And it really is fascinating. Like, I hear that a lot, where people. And I think there's something about the way I present the music that isn't as sort of folky as, you know, I'm not sure exactly how to describe it. I think it has a contemporary, somewhat, there's edgy at times, you know, element to it that people are really drawn into it. And they're like, wow, I don't even like folk music, but I like what you do. So for me, I think I don't find that I explain a lot, but more just I do what I do as fully and passionately as I can, and then that's what basically shapes the perception of people. You know, that's what draws him in or doesn't, you know.
Speaking of Springsteen, do you think his being involved with the Seeger Sessions in the past several years has helped folk music? Have you seen a resurgence, a more renewed interest because of the stuff that he did, or is it hard to tell?
You know what, I would say, let's see, the short of that is I think there are so many people and situations and concerts going on all the time that I think Bruce Springsteen, you know, he is, you know, super, you know, mainstream, well-known. But to be honest, I don't really think that his involvement in the Seeger Sessions has done more than what, you know, I don't know. I think about like a movie like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where it was super focused on like old-time traditional bluegrass kind of stuff.
Right.
I think that movie actually was a very powerful transition in bringing acoustic music into the mainstream more. I think David Grisman and Olden in the Way, 1970s, you know, that album brought acoustic and folk music to the mainstream. Like, you know, and so I hesitate to put too much emphasis on what Bruce Springsteen did with Pete Seeger. Because I think there's been, and there are many examples of really powerful situations that have helped folk music and acoustic music become more, you know, mainstream. But
fair enough. Listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. In the background, you hear Joe Crookston singing Red Rooster in the Mash Pile. Joe is our guest today, and we will be continuing to talk to him about writing, songwriting, and what he really enjoys about traveling around the country. Stick with us.
In the mash pile, saying cock-a-dock-a-dock-a-doo. Well, the boys are making whiskey and the rooster's drinking too. Red rooster in the mash pile, saying cock-a-dock-a-dock-a-doo. Well, the boys are making whiskey and the rooster's drinking too. Here we go. Red rooster in the mash pile, saying cock-a-dock-a-dock-a-doo. Well, the boys are making whiskey and the rooster's drinking too. Back by the woodshed in the sugar maple grove, Red Rooster's drinking by the whiskey cooking stove. Red Rooster in the mash pile, saying cock-a-dock-a-dock-a-doo. Let's hear you out. Well, the boys are making whiskey and the rooster's drinking too.
Red Rooster in the mash pile. Let's switch back to some writing questions.
Okay.
The chicken and the egg question, what comes first for you, the lyrics or the melody, or is it organic?
It's okay. I would say that I think my best songs lately are really songs that I have a very specific idea. I'm not one that tends to just write like, oh, I'm sitting at the table and I feel this way and something happens to come out. I have done that, and I have a few songs that are like that, but typically for me is I know exactly where I'm going with the song, and it's more about filling in the puzzle pieces prior to that end. So I know that I'm going to write a song about a kid who is locked up in jail and who is, you know, his name is Freddie, and he's, you know, this whole thing, you know, like I know that's what the song is going to be about. And then I start at the beginning and I work to fill in the pieces. What I tend to do is kind of simultaneously work on the music and the lyrics at the same time. More of what I think I start with is phrasing, actually. the phrasing of, like, if I'm singing, when my life is over and I have gone away, basically something where I get the phrasing of it down, that's more important to me than getting a melody, because typically later, as the song develops, I change the melody and make it more of what I want and more powerful. So I typically start with the concepts and then the phrasing and then the music. Actually, here's one thing that sometimes I write songs in a bluegrass style where I'll play really straightforward chords and I'll play them very simple, like a bluegrass song, because it forces me to say exactly what I want to say and get it clear. And then I actually open it up and create music that is a little bit more contemporary sounding. That helps me write, actually. Yeah.
Okay. So, just out of curiosity, how long does it usually take to write a song? Are you really quick about it? It sounds like you've got a plan that you sit down, like you say, you don't seem to be the tortured artist in the garret somewhere slaving away on the same song for, you know,
yeah,
2 years.
No, I don't think of myself as a tortured artist. I think of myself a little bit more as just like a blue collar craftsman of songs. It's kind of, I mean, maybe that's not as sexy or something like that, but to me, I really relate to that idea of being a craftsman, like a cabinet maker. You know, it's like you got your thing, you're squaring it up and you're shaving it and you're planing it down. That's how I approach my songs. And typically, the song I wrote about Abel Baker, Charlie and Dog, my grandfather, I spent about 3 weeks knowing that I was going to write a song about the runways that were built by my grandfather and these other men. And I started singing some verses and working on, and it wasn't working. I was stuck. So I kind of stuck with it, kept going. And then I thought, what if I sing it from the perspective of my grandfather as if my grandfather is singing this song? And as soon as I made that transition, it took me about 2 days of, you know, hard work and focus, but it just came out, you know, very, very well. And so to me, you know, if I spend 3 weeks on a song and getting it nailed down, that's about typical, I would say. Yeah, but a lot of craft. Every preposition and adverb, and, you know, I really get into the craft of it. And I take a lot of pride in that.
A lot of performers now have their lyrics on their website, and I think that's a really interesting and cool move, because they're presenting it as, in some ways, almost a standalone.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that?
Yeah, I haven't put my lyrics on my website, but not for any reason other than I just haven't done it. I think that I could print, you know, a book of my lyrics, and I think people would be interested in just simply reading them and would get a lot out of them. I do think they're more powerful with the music attached. I think that entering into it emotionally and, you know, the repetition is really beautiful with the music. But I would be very proud to see my lyrics printed in a book and read through them. I'd be real proud of them.
You know, that reminds me of a song of yours, John Jones.
Yeah.
That has the violin or the fiddle adding a lot to the song. Was that something that you originally envisioned as being part of the song, or is that something you thought later that with, you know, the lyrics that it would fit in particularly well? How was that song created?
I would say that I wanted there to be this chugging rhythm, and when I wrote it, it was, you know, ding, 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 mama, I'm going to miss, you know, just a real sense of like a train kind of chugging along. And so for me, kind of the way I would approach that song is like I would never put a piano in that song, because a piano would ground it inside a house somewhere in a building that, do you know what I mean? And it would feel inauthentic to a song where this guy's running, you know, and he's basically escaping a plantation as a slave and running 300 miles up to New York. So for me, all the instruments on the song need to be an instrument that you might be able to actually carry with you or take with you on this. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
right, yeah.
More organic outdoor kind of instrument like that. Those little things matter to me a lot. I wouldn't put an oboe on that song. You know what I mean? Just, it wouldn't make sense. So the fiddle really came about. I think of the fiddle, and Judy Hyman, who played the fiddle on that song, she has a real rhythmic kind of style to it, and to her playing, and I thought that would be a great addition to kind of the motion forward, you know, like this guy's running, you know, and the fiddle can add a lot of that tension and kind of motion to the song.
What's the difference between like rural and city life for you when you're writing your songs? A lot of these seem to be rural. Because I think the Finger Lakes region is pretty rural.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been there.
Yeah, definitely is. Rolling hills, wineries, mm-hmm. absolutely. And then, yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time in, you know, West Philadelphia and Minneapolis and New York. And, you know, so for me, I think I have this kind of, well, more than even dual personality. I think that I've spent a lot of time in, you know, big urban centers, working at juvenile detention centers with, you know, youth and that kind of thing. And then I spent a lot of time, like, you know, I grew up being a dairy farmer. And so I think for me, I have kind of a foot in both the very rural, natural world, and then also just a much more urban, you know, situation as well. Is your question, how do those two influence my writing, or what we?
How do you see those as influence? Because a lot of times, I think what I'm mostly imagining is that people will use one to inspire the other. You know, say you grow up in a rural area. Oftentimes, it seems like those people will go to the city and find something to write about. Whereas people who grow up in the city will often go to rural places to find something that inspires them. And it always seems to me to be the getting out of where you usually are and going somewhere else. But I think you've got songs that are on either side, and a lot of people do. But I'm just curious, you know, which you find more useful from a, you know, a music making standpoint.
I think I see them both extremely useful, equally, and I would say that. Let's see. Going back to one of the first questions you asked me about why I write a song or what I look for when I begin to write a song is the human element. So I could look at a rural song like John Jones that has this historical, you know, kind of natural world, kind of, you know, old school kind of feel to it, this slave who's escaping, and he's singing to his mama, and he, you know, and then you could go to Freddy the Falcon, which is about this 17-year-old boy who is locked up in jail. Both songs are about the human condition and struggle and triumph or hope of moving to something more profound or better for themselves. Even though one's in an urban, you know, city, you know, jail, and one of them is in, you know, running through the woods, escaping a plantation, they're both about the human movement from one place in their life to another, you know, and to me, that's the consistency. And it's just that the scene and the theater set is, you know, of each of those is set in a different place. But I do find, you know, what I think is important too is that I might have a, you know, 59-year-old guy who's like, oh my God, that song John Jones is amazing. And, you know, he really relates to it and learns how to play it on the guitar himself. And then I might have a 16-year-old kid or a boy or a girl who is like, wow, that Freddy the Falcon song. So what I find that's important to me is that my audience tends to be, especially in places where people know me, it tends to be very intergenerational. I have 20-year-olds who are there. I have, you know, some teens. I have 30-year-olds and 85-year-olds. And that really excites me, the idea of music that's just spanning really intergeneration. I think that speaks to the idea that the songs and the writing really is, you know, about the human condition and, you know, so, yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing about the human condition.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for talking to us today. For more information on Joe Crookston, visit www.sixstring.org. You can also catch him this Saturday when he's in town as part of the Six String Concert Series. and that's at the same website. Join us next time for poet Patricia Jabbar Wesley. That's Monday at 7 p.m. on WCRS, Central Ohio's community radio station. Till next time, this is Doug Dangler from The Ohio State University and the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing saying, keep writing.